Welcome to the podcast, Imperial Security Bureau. If you don't know, it's the CIA from Star Wars. But today, we're not talking so much about cybersecurity. We're switching it up a little bit. We've got a really unique guest I'm excited about. His name's Thomas Merck. He's a management consultant, strategic business consultant from Shadow Hornet. We met back in 2014, early in my staffing career. We had a big pitch meeting with Red Hat. We're not going to talk about it because I bombed it. But anyway, we're going to dodge that subject. Here's how they prepped me for this meeting. 1 year in staffing. Hey, Blake, we need you to get smart on the screening process. Okay. Yeah, sure. Wrote down a bunch of notes and spoke too much in the meeting and said some stupid stuff. But live and learn. Anyway, let's visit Tom's LinkedIn. Here he is, Tom Merck. He's a wealth of knowledge. If you go back in his job history, he's had some really interesting experiences here. And we'll just scroll on back, right? Started as an analyst at Amundi Pioneer, and they were a division of Smith Breeden. So that's where he kind of cut his teeth in these large enterprise acquisitions and large-scale projects. He leveraged that into an eight-year career at Red Hat, where he led some of the largest initiatives that they had. From there, he became a White House advisor for their Rural Council, U.S. Department of Labor and Technology Workforce Development. He was an executive director for Relias. He was the managing director for M4 Solutions. Might have had something to do with placing him there and my colleague, Chapman Porterfield. I love you, brother. And now he's the managing director and principal consultant for Shadow Hornet. This is his consulting company, and he's focused in the telecom industry, energy, electric utilities, financial services, fintech, technology services. He's helped companies buy and sell. He's had 11 successful exits. He's got a ton of data that I feel like everyone's going to be super interested in. I know I was, and I'm super excited to chat with him. Let's dive in. Here's Tom. All right. Welcome to the podcast, Tom. I'm excited to have you. How you doing, man?
Doing well. Really excited to be here, Blake. Good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you. Our history goes all the way back, I think, to 2014, Red Hat days. I was at Etain Group. You know, we have to give old Chapman Porterfield a shout out here. He's the guy who hired me at Etain, and you guys are good friends, and we've maintained a relationship ever since, man. It's been awesome.
Most certainly. It's hard to believe it's back almost 15 years now.
That is insane. Well, a couple of warm-up questions for you. I normally ask, what's your favorite Star Wars movie? But now I'm just asking generically, what's your favorite movie and what's your favorite band? What are you listening to?
All-time favorite movie is The Insider. So it's Russell Crowe, Al Pacino, about a corporate whistleblower in the tobacco industry. It's probably the only movie I can quote. And if I'm quoting a movie, my wife will guess almost instantaneously that it's from The Insider. So that's by far my favorite movie.
Okay, interesting. I think I have seen that. Russell Crowe's an incredible actor. Yeah, I have to rewatch that one.
Yeah, he did it. So he went from a corporate scientist to Gladiator in the span of 1 year, and then won the Academy Award the next year for Gladiator. So you did it the year before.
Yeah, I got to rewatch it now. There's another one. Was he in A Beautiful Mind?
Yes.
Yeah. He's got some good ones, man. I love everything he's in. What's your favorite band?
You might not know this, but I'm a musician. I actually taught guitar for about a decade. I played in a couple of bands, blues and hard rock bands. So my favorite bands of all time, I have to say, it starts with Robert Johnson and the 1930s Delta Blues. That was the foundation of all rock music. So get Robert Johnson. There's still no one who's played like him on the slide guitar to this day. So Robert Johnson gets the shout out there. And then ultimately, you know, I liked bands in the 80s like Guns N' Roses. And then more recently, believe it or not, I've gotten into the musicals. So I'll play with my kids and my wife. We'll be rocking out on Hamilton, the musical, hardcore. So really varied taste, Blake. Real varied taste.
Hey, I like it. I like it. Yeah, these days I just hop in the golf cart and tell my phone, you know, Morgan Wallen radio and just whatever it plays. So yeah, man, I'm so excited to talk to you. I think the audience is going to love some of the information we're going to share. And I've got some notes here. For those who don't know, we had lunch yesterday and we had a little brainstorming session. Before we get into it, man, tell us, what's your story? How'd you become the man, the myth, the legend, Tom Merck?
So, right out of school, I came out of school in the recession of the turn of the century, right in the midst of the tech bubble boom. So it was a tough job market, and ultimately, I wanted to go into technology. I'd studied small business development and small business management, but I'd also specialized in information technology. So I was a coder at the time, and couldn't really find jobs at that time in the midst of the first tech bubble bursting. So ultimately made my way into financial services and became a vice president at a firm called Smith Breeden Associates, a global hedge fund manager and asset manager, and had an amazing experience there all the way through the next crisis, which was the financial crisis of 2007, 2008. So when that financial bubble burst, I used a lot of the tech skills that I had attained to respond to client requests to help our team get data that was hard to find and bring it together. And I was able to parlay that experience into joining the world's open source leader, Red Hat, at the time, where I worked for about a decade. Started off as an analyst there and ultimately ended up as a senior manager and on the operational excellence team and the M&A team. And that opened a lot of doors in the industry. So I went on to lead software organization, telecommunication software organization, exit that organization. I get M&A experience and then really get a comprehensive view of how business works and how technology is interrelated to the business decisions that we make. So that was the route here, Blake. Long and storied path, rife with crises in between and some career pivots, but really happy to be here and talk about, my perspective on the market and what we're going to talk about here today.
I think, you've got such a unique perspective and you bring a lot of value to any conversation you're in. Tell us a little bit about your company though, Shadow Hornet. How'd you come up with the name and what do you guys do?
Yeah, so after exiting a battery ventures firm, I was given the ability to start my own venture, which is a dream of mine for years. Potentially my whole life, I've wanted to run my own business. And that exit gave me the flexibility and gave me the exposure and the experience to start Shadow Hornet Consulting. So we've operated about 3 years now. And really what we focus on, we take that unique point of view and we help firms that are looking to sell their businesses now or 4 years in the future through the M&A process. We help them prevent the million-dollar mistakes that are so common in selling a business. We help them maximize their valuation and we help guide them to the right buyers and exit scenarios by making better technology decisions, better operational decisions. Some examples of things that we've done, Blake, we've guided our clients on how to effectively use AI versus labor and cut through some of the AI BS to affect some real-world results in a short period of time, all in a fiscal year. We've helped our clients grow and scale their technical operations through nearshoring in South America, Central America, and the Caribbean, and even in rural America. So scaling out through lower cost areas in rural America. And then we help firms understand how their decisions today will impact their valuation and sales prospects years out. And we exclusively serve the energy utilities, telecommunications, and the financial services industries.
Nice. And you've had, I think it's 46 engagements, 11 successful exits, and you were a former White House advisor. I mean, wow, that's it's an incredible repertoire there. But what are you focused on most recently?
Most recently, it's the intersection of technology, labor, and technology solutions. And how is AI impacting professional technical services? And then how is that creating new opportunities for businesses to enhance their valuation, to lower their costs, to enhance their profitability, or to redefine what they offer to the market? And so we're helping a number of companies reposition themselves. We're helping them explore AI in a way that makes sense, where they can cut through, as I mentioned, the AI BS that's so pervasive out there to affect some real-world results. And then also, how do they leverage this concept of global hybrid teams? So right now, technical labor is available anywhere on the planet. And where can you get that quality? Where can you get that trust? Where you can get that consistency with your own culture to where using global labor is not threatening to your US operations? Those are some of the challenges that we're working through now. And it's a really exciting time that's rife with opportunity. And there's honestly a lot of pain in the industry too. So we're helping our clients manage that pain and then emerge through on the other side. And that's really the spirit behind our name, Shadow Hornet. We're going to help you get out of the shadows, whatever those shadows are. We're going to help you get out of the shadows aggressively. We're going to help you beat your competitors before they even see you coming.
I love that. Going to be plenty of demand for that because companies seem to be, you know, dealing with a lot of uncertainty, not sure which direction to go in. So having a second opinion and some advice from someone like you could be incredibly valuable to get them over a hump, or, you know, they're on the fence about which decisions to make. So, and we're in a down economy, right? And it seems to be getting progressively worse here. And I just lost my job at JobBot due to poor production. And there seemed to be overall just very little demand for tech recruiting. And I felt it coming on starting this time last year. And some folks are saying, you know, this is just a cycle, right? We've seen cycles before. We'll recover. We'll see this cycle again. And I'm kind of worried it may not be just another cycle this time, because, you know, it seems to be like it's a different animal. It's like a perfect storm of stuff that we're sailing through right now. And with the emergence of AI, there's even more pressure and an opportunity to cut costs and reduce headcount via replacing people with AI. So what's your perspective on what's happening right now in the economy and around the world?
There's a lot of data to suggest that your point of view is right, that this is a down economy, particularly if you look through it from the lens of the technical labor services market. There's also a lot of evidence to suggest we actually are in a very strong economy that in some ways is leaving technology behind as it redefines itself. Our economy is in the midst of a redefinition. If you look at some of the stats that I mentioned that can support your point of view, technical services, when you look at the technology market, there's technical services, there's data and infrastructure, and then there's software. Infrastructure is thriving. In fact, the top seven, the magnificent seven companies that you'll hear about, that's your Microsoft, your NVIDIA's now, Amazon, Google, they have invested over the course of last quarter, $100 billion with a B dollars in capital investment in data center expansion, in the AI ecosystem, and in affiliated services like power optimization, network optimization surrounding the AI ecosystem. So I agree, if you look at it from a lens of technical labor, 600,000 jobs are on track to have been eliminated from the American economy over the past 3 to 3.5 years. It's staggering. It's unprecedented. The Wall Street Journal says the number of jobs lost in this 3-year span eclipsed that of the prior tech bubble in 2001. So technology labor is down. Tech is thriving right now, largely on the back of this AI transition and a lot of the capital investment that's shifting into AI infrastructure. And that's going to bolster returns for the next couple of quarters into potentially next year. And I think that's a positive trend. It's creating some new opportunities. They're not as labor intensive. So if you think about capital expenditure, historically, over the time that we've built our careers, Blake, there's been a lot of capital expenditure into large software projects, cloud enablement, cloud feature development, large scale platforms that are continuously getting iterated upon. And that required a lot of people, a lot of developers, architects, analysts, agile personnel, scrum masters, coaches, program managers, project managers. Well, now that we're seeing diminished returns from software, we don't need as many people to drive ROI in the marketplace. So that shift is happening where you're seeing investment being made to hardware infrastructure. And that's not going to require as many people. And it's going to require the people who potentially are left behind to reskill, reassess, and potentially reallocate themselves into different industries. That's some of what I'm seeing from my market point of view. Like,
you mentioned some SIA statistics that were kind of shocking to me. Do you remember what those were?
Yeah. Staffing industry analysts, the gold standard for analysis in the staffing and workforce solutions industry, indicated that the $218 billion staffing and workforce services market experienced its first ever decline last year. And it was a slight decline from that $218 billion in the range of 1% to 2%. Staffing industry analysts just 2 months ago indicated that we are on track to see a 5% decline now by the end of 2024. So we hit the peak of the market. We saw the first ever decline in the market for technical staffing, technical services, workforce solutions. And now we're seeing an accelerated decline forecast through the end of this year. So pretty shocking statistics, unprecedented statistics. But an indication, like what you said, it's not going to be the same. It's not going to bounce back. Potentially, that's right, because the industry is seeing unprecedented data and an unprecedented response to today's market conditions.
Yeah, so not a new cycle, but like a new future is emerging entirely. And I don't think it's just tech. I mean, I'm hearing it impacting other industries as well. I was at my daughter's swim meet the other day, and I had a poolside conversation with a neighbor who works in commercial construction. They're involved in big projects, apartment complexes, commercial buildings, and whatnot. And she said at this point, they're only finishing up projects that have been in flight for the past few years. And there are no new projects on the books. And she doesn't know what next year, 2026, 2027 will even look like, because, you know, after they finish up what they have pending, there's nothing.
Yeah. And you could corroborate that with the past 7 employment reports from the U.S. Department of Labor and from the Federal Reserve and its own data. So while we've seen job growth consecutively over 7 concurrent periods, it's been limited to 4 sectors. Now, interestingly, construction is one of those sectors, but with construction facing some of the financing challenges from high interest rates, there's definitely large-scale construction projects that are being postponed, delayed, or canceled in some cases. But it has exhibited some growth, but primarily the growth has come from 2 sectors, or 3 sectors, call it. Healthcare, services such as retail services. So if you think retail workers, restaurant workers, servers, those sort of skill sets, those are 2 of the major drivers.
So the last year or so, and I've been looking at the stats, saw the deals coming through at JobBot, and it's not that there weren't any deals. I mean, there was a lot of people that were doing just fine, but all the deals that were coming through were accounting and finance, legal, and healthcare. Very few, if any, tech deals. Those are the markets that are doing okay.
Yeah, and that third area from the Federal Reserve data and the U.S. Department of Labor is government. So it makes a lot of sense when you get into the financial, you get into the legal ecosystem, you might be seeing some pull from the government sector, which is growing and has grown, particularly through this administration and over the past 7 months. It is a bright area right now. Is that an area that entails high growth? Potentially not. And there's a lot of sensitivity to that right now. So certainly a lot of challenges in the economy today. And it's not the economy that we've seen over the past 15 years or so, Blake. It's certainly not what we're used to.
No. And if there's anything we need right now, it's probably a bigger government. You know, that's the solution to everything.
The joke is that's customer one. That's Fortune One, or Fortune One is the federal government. They eclipse all other Fortune 500 entities in terms of their spending power. But yeah, obviously there's some diverging opinions on that.
We talked yesterday a little bit about 3 fronts that's kind of hitting us right now, these waves, and it was offshore, nearshore, and AI. You have a lot of experience in the nearshore side. So are there any stats around companies nearshoring that folks might find interesting?
Definitely. And I characterize this by, we've heard over the past 15 years in our career that companies wanted to win the war on talent, and the war on talent would define success into the future. So companies were more than willing to invest in getting the best and brightest people into their organization, as many as possible, compensating them at a high level, and reaping the benefit of having all that labor. I would suggest that what we're seeing now is a secular shift from the war for labor to the war on labor. We are seeing the market wage a war on labor that's being fought on 3 fronts. And as you mentioned, it's AI, it's nearshore, offshore, and then it's diminished capital spending. It's diminished capital spending on software projects. So some of the stats that we're seeing, a World Economic Forum, often reviled, sometimes respected, but no doubt an influential organization, suggests that 30% of jobs in technology will be eliminated by 2030. That's 30% of jobs will be eliminated by 2030 out of the ecosystem. And I think we're seeing that. I think we're on track when you look at being on pace to lose 600,000 jobs over the course of the past 3 to 3.5 years. We're seeing AI, without a doubt, take jobs and eliminate jobs from the technology ecosystem. So that's one shocking finding. Just released yesterday, Blake, ADP, the payroll provider, payroll platform provider, very well respected in terms of labor statistics, indicated that there are less software developers today in 2024 than there were in 2018. Said another way, there were more software developers in the U.S. employed in 2018 than there are in 2024. Just shocking, right? Like, hard to believe.
Crazy.
But true. And they just released a press release on it yesterday. That's ADP Research. If you look at these three fronts, AI looking to eliminate 30% of jobs by 2030, nearshore, offshore, if you look at those separately, offshore, which primarily means India, to some extent it's Eastern Europe, to some extent it's Southeast Asia, but Asia Pacific, but India is primarily what we're talking about. It has seen a 4.1% growth consecutively over the past few years, which means U.S. jobs are definitely going to India. India is growing. You can look at TCS, Tata Consultancy Services. If you look at a quote of their financial returns over the past 4 years, straight up, almost exponential up. Whereas you look at U.S.-based providers and it's down. U.S. losses are India's gains right now. And that's taking about 4% of jobs out of the U.S. Now you couple that with nearshore. So nearshore primarily means Central America, South America, and the Caribbean. 2.1% of jobs now are being sent from the U.S. nearshore. So when you couple 2.1%, 4.2%, 4.1%, 4.2%, and AI's impact, 11% of jobs potentially in the U.S. in the tech ecosystem are being lost to these trends. And then you stack diminished capital spending on software projects. You know, how much more can we reap out of some of these cloud platforms we've deployed? How much more ROI can we get out of feature development? Companies are saying we're seeing diminished marginal benefit from the software projects. So capital spending on is also impacting that. So you're absolutely seeing losses, but you're not necessarily seeing 11% disappear. You're just seeing it being reallocated from the United States, and in some cases, Canada, North America, to other global locations, primarily India, primarily South America at this stage.
It does make sense. We've spent a ton of money on software, and at this point, like, adding a new feature or new widget, you know, the ROI on that is probably going to be pretty low. We probably maximized the benefit of software. If anything, there's just too many software options out there. I mean, it's make your head spin. There's dozens of options for every little niche thing that you can think of. And then AI coming in. I mean, if I was going to be a tech startup or had a software idea, I'd be very concerned right now about dumping any time and energy into that, because probably AI is going to do that eventually. All these smaller tech startups now are kind of at risk, because it would only take Google or Microsoft to turn on some feature that AI can just eliminate the whole need for their product altogether.
It is. If you start to follow NVIDIA and some of the players in the ecosystem, Microsoft, Google, in terms of what they have on the roadmap and what they're thinking about, they're not playing three-dimensional chess. They're not playing four-dimensional chess. They're playing quantum chess. They're talking about compute ability that's incomprehensible to our human mind, and how do you leverage that? And many are saying that this race, this AI race, this war to be at the forefront of AI, is because AI will be the last innovation humans ever create. And there's a great article in The Atlantic about that recently, about the race to be the last. But you can start to see it. So these, to your point, Blake, these companies are thinking well beyond even the bounds of human reality. Neuralink and what Musk is doing with connectivity from brainwaves to physical devices, this is quantum chess. And the beneficiary is going to be those who are in the ecosystem, and those who are not going to benefit are primarily high-cost tech labor that doesn't evolve.
Yeah, I have a lot of folks that don't think recruiting is ever going to go away, and I don't think it'll ever fully go away, but I do think that there'll be about 50% at least reduction in the number of recruiters that are needed, because AI can do so much of the role. And you need a human touch, but it doesn't need to be necessarily involved in the first touch point, right? It can get involved, the humans can get involved after that first screen. AI can easily do the first screen, and they can easily look at the resume and grade the relevancy score and ask the initial dozen questions just to make sure the person's a fit. You can easily do that. So it's inevitable, but I hope it takes a while to get there. But it does make sense, though, that there's been a shift from software to now the data center GPU output, and then the power to supply the data centers and to keep the, you know, the GPUs running and cooled and all that. And now you were even telling me about this new industry that's going to be emerging just based on, you know, new ways to generate power. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you look at the side effects of this massive investment into the AI ecosystem and $100 billion over a quarter, I mean, we're looking at $1 trillion+ that have been invested over the past 18 months in the ecosystem. And then you're seeing massive returns from NVIDIA, Broadcom recently, and the semiconductor universe. And what that's having the effect of is creating new opportunities, and it's redefining what growth looks like for companies. So one area where we're pretty heavily engaged and we're seeing a lot of opportunity and we're seeing a lot of action is in power optimization and distributed energy resource management, DERM, virtual power plants. How do you effectively draw power, AC power, from multiple sources, and then control that and deliver it back to the grid? Grid integration, so looking at alternative energy, primarily solar, primarily wind, but also think about biofuels. How do you integrate those resources, which are continuously generating energy? How do you allocate that across the grid? Even all the way down to grid re-architecture, so using carbon fiber transmission lines to shorten or to maximize the efficacy and eliminate some of the costs associated with step-up transformers. We're starting to get into a lot of that consulting, sensor-based geospatial analysis. So rather than just managing and plotting your network on a map, using sensors at intervals to intuit what assets are deployed in the field, there's a lot of really exciting evolution innovation that's happening right now. And that power space, power management is absolutely an area where we're probably seeing the most demand, and we're seeing a lot of progressive, innovative thinking, but it's also a very early stage market. And it's all being driven by this massive investment in the AI ecosystem. These NVIDIA GPUs are known, and this was a Goldman Sachs report, are known to drive 7 times more power consumption than a traditional full stack in a data center. So where's that power going to come from? Micro generation now becomes a theme. We're talking about nuclear powered data centers, micro nuclear powered data centers. I know, Blake, you've pointed out another example of a really innovative company using nuclear fission, liquid-based nuclear fission.
Yeah, Thorcon, modular nuclear power plants fueled by, it's called a molten salt. This company can build you a nuclear reactor power generator, like a modular home, basically, ship it to you in pieces, set it up, and then it runs on molten salt, which apparently is a lot safer. Unlike traditional nuclear power, it's a delicate balance between different items that keep it in check and keep it from just going haywire and turning into Chernobyl. The molten salt reactors, if you don't continue feeding it the salt fuel, apparently it will just die out on its own. So it's a lot safer, although you do have to deal with the waste product that's going to be radioactive for years, billion years or whatever. It's still safer, and they can build it and ship it to you. It's crazy.
It is. So first, with their technology, you don't need to hire Homer Simpson to run the plant. So there's no personnel associated with the operations, which is both incredible and scary to me, at least to some extent. But even what you mentioned with, so when you look at the supply chain for distribution of hazardous waste, it's creating a new industry, new opportunity, and new ways to think about how do we get modular based radioactive waste out of a designated area. Well, we comply with all local regulations in the jurisdictions that we cross. And ultimately, how do we dispose or reprovision that waste? Obviously, there's an existing industry, but this is a new challenge that's being presented to an existing industry, which creates some room for innovation. That's why I'm really bullish. I think we're seeing quite a lot of this innovation, R&D, research translate into new and progressive concepts all around modernization of a 19th, 20th century infrastructure that served us well, but isn't going to serve us in the future. So there's a lot that's happening. And what I think we're going to see in tech is a reprovision of some of those knowledge assets and some of the knowledge and capabilities and human capital that's been working on building really excellent software and high performing software. We're going to see a reallocation into a higher growth ecosystem over the course of the next 5 to maybe 10 years. So it's going to be different, and people are going to have to pick up different skills and think about things different ways. And it's going to usher in some new types of skill sets that are really important.
Yeah, well, you're the first one I've ever heard say instead of a war for talent, it's going to be a war on talent. And now American workers are going to be left behind because everything's going to be offshored and nearshored. And that's been happening for a while, but now it's happening at a more rapid pace. And now we got to compete with the AI. So that's the third front. So where will the opportunities be for American workers moving forward, do you think?
So if you look at where the growth is going to happen, how the economy is melding and evolving, morphing, if you will, the ability to understand an industry and then recognize there are multiple solutions to some of the problems that you face, which might be technology solutions, they might be process solutions, they might be out of the box solutions. Someone who can couple that industry knowledge and awareness of problems in the industry and then leverage technology knowledge to be able to solve those problems is going to be in incredibly high demand. And that means critical thinking. That means you can't necessarily just be a technical expert. You can't hang your hat on one enterprise platform, like an ERP platform. You're probably not going to be able to make a career the way that people have for 30 years, knowing one technology like Salesforce or Oracle. You're going to need over time to become an applied technology specialist. And I think that's going to benefit those who are critically thinking, those who emphasize that skill set, that creative mindset, that neuroplasticity to think about what's interesting out there. What do I need to learn more about? Not necessarily thinking about the credentials, but thinking about a quest for knowledge. And then how to couple that knowledge with technical knowledge or pair it with people who understand technology and the industry and then apply that to solutions. So I think that's the opportunity for American workers. And I also think being closer to the tangible. So when you look at industries that can potentially be improved by AI, but are not going to be replaced by AI in the short and intermediate term, that's where there's going to be a lot of opportunity. So coupling technical knowledge with the trades, for example, electric trades, HVAC, plumbing, ecosystem, power management, there's going to be opportunities to rethink how some of that's done with sensor technology, robotic technology, as well as just doing it the old way, rolling up the sleeves and getting it done. And I think U.S. workers are going to have to be less aristocratic in thinking, I'm not going to get my hands dirty. They're going to have to think more than they ever have. They're going to have to be more global and recognize that people, just because they don't speak English or don't come from America, can be better than you. I think we have to be humble and say that. And I've seen that. I recently visited South America on a business trip. And I can tell you, we have to acknowledge that the resources from other countries are smarter, are harder working, and can do things better at a price point that's half or less than what American workers are making. So I think there's some humility as well. And if we can be humble, creative, err towards seeking knowledge, and not just focusing on credentials, but really being immersed in knowledge. You know, America is going to come out as a leader. There's going to be a lot of work to be done in the meantime.
Yeah, I can see it, man. There's a lot of risk to hiring American workers because we're picky, we're needy, we're moody. We like the best of the best, and we don't like to be overworked and, you know, all the stuff, right? So no shock that you can send it to Latin America and they're just thrilled to give it 110%. They won't complain, just get it done and with a smile on their face. So, and maybe the safest job in America moving forward is going to be electricians, plumbers, HVAC technicians, people who can fix the robots. Maybe the manual labor is going to win out. All the white collar computer workers, they're going to continue to become more and more limited.
I think there's going to be a little of both, right? You're obviously seeing a shift back towards, and you're also seeing an erosion of trust in the market. You look at these layoffs from major companies, where's the job security for the white collar worker, for the high-tech professional now? Once upon a time, you could count on getting a job within 2 to 4 weeks. We knew it, Blake, we saw it. You had some issues, you could jump ship across the street, 2 to 4 weeks, you'd have a job. Now we're seeing some of the best workers in the market. We're seeing Ivy League grads, we're seeing MIT grads not have a job for as many as 14 months, I've seen. Some of the best people I've ever worked with, I've seen new college graduates struggle to get jobs with advanced degrees, focus in NLP, in the machine learning ecosystem. You're starting to see an erosion of trust and an erosion of opportunity that's going to push more people towards the trades over time. It certainly is going to make recent college graduates and those students in college think about it to a greater extent, or even before making that college decision, think about it.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, I used to say I chose the wrong profession. I should have been a developer. And everyone that, a high schooler or someone in college, I just said, hey, learn to be a software engineer, learn Python, learn React. And just yesterday, I met with a very talented senior full stack .NET developer, TypeScript, .NET, .NET Core, Azure Cloud, API development, even some machine learning in there, and can't find a job. Cannot find a job. Been on the market for 4 months, and they vented to me a little bit about they were in process for some jobs that kind of they got ghosted or the roles got put on hold. And even through referrals of friends that, old hiring managers that kind of wanted to hire them but couldn't, like their funding got pulled or whatever. So what am I going to tell high schoolers and college grads now? I think cybersecurity is going to be one of the safer computer jobs moving forward because as the robots and AI become smarter, there'll be more people needed to watch what the heck they're doing, and to secure against other nation states that are trying to play in the AI war, the AI Game of Thrones that we're going to all witness happen.
100%. It's interesting. Back in 2017, I had the opportunity to spend some time at the U.S. Army War College, and one of the topics was cybersecurity. And what we learned was the most sophisticated cybersecurity personnel were those from Estonia, because Estonia had been attacked by Russia ever since its independence with advanced cyber attacks. And so the response ultimately led to innovations and led to a core of professionals who were needed in that industry who were head and shoulders above everywhere else. And our own cyber command was learning a lot from what Estonia was doing. So to your point, there's going to be bad nation states. There's going to be bad actors who continue to employ and incorporate AI into attacks. We know a major retailer, we've been talking to a major retailer who's facing a problem of what's known as Grinch bots. And those are progressively learning AI attacks on the retail supply chain to reprovision supply from one destination to another and then scalp it. So, there's going to be more of that sort of stuff out there. And I agree with you. Cybersecurity is going to be constantly evolving. It's also going to raise the cost of technology investment because you have to factor in cybersecurity into every major capital investment you make around software. And that's going to raise the cost, and that's also going to challenge ROI. So, do we start to see diminished investment in software over the next 10 to 20 years because of the copious need for cybersecurity? Maybe we do, because ROI is certainly challenged.
For sure. I used to get into some stats with some senior leaders in IT at some big fintech and insurtech firms, and they would tell me that typically IT spend for a company is between 1% and 5%. And it's 5% if you're trying to do a ton of modernization and whatnot. Do you have any insight in what that looks like now? And then what percentage of that IT spend is cybersecurity?
A big trend that we've seen is operational budgets have declined in IT departments. So we've seen for a major client over $1 billion in revenue cut their IT spend by 40%, their IT operational budget by 40% year over year. That's a major financial services institution. Part of the issue is cybersecurity. You have to siphon funds now into the cybersecurity ecosystem. So we're seeing a lot more sophistication. We're seeing a lot more prevalence of ransomware attacks. In terms of budgeting, we're seeing more capital dollars being spent on cybersecurity than potentially that we ever have been. But we're seeing them spent as capital projects, so hardening projects to ensure that assets have some notion of cybersecurity protection. We're starting to see a shift from the operating budget, where it's an ongoing need. We need some cybersecurity people down in the basement to help us, to now we need platforms. We need hardening mechanisms. We need ongoing professional services. So let's make a capital investment in the security and defense of our ROI and defense of our assets. That's the biggest trend we're seeing, Blake, is that shift from operating budget to capital budget.
Interesting. The more you know about cyber, it's like wearing a bulletproof vest. You can still get shot in the face. It's just you need a good game plan about who comes and helps. It's like playing whack-a-mole. It's a bottomless money pit that you need to keep sinking into cybersecurity because every time you fill a gap, Oh, there's this whole new thing.
Exactly. So it's metal work. It's work that's associated with the work that needs to be done. If you look at healthcare, Ascension Healthcare Network was recently hacked, and it impacted critical care at 19 facilities nationwide because of a direct cyber attack. Well, the dollars they need to spend to respond to that, the resources they need to spend to respond to that event in that critical time of need are not being spent on improving healthcare delivery, are not being spent on patient service, and then they create a need to harden those assets in the future. So next year's capital budget is going to see more spending on cybersec, less on facilities improvement, less on personnel training programs, less on what can actually improve the core business that they're in. So to your point, it is somewhat of a bottomless pit. And at some point it challenges ROI. And what we could see over the next 10 to 15 years is that investment in cybersecurity becomes so progressively great that it eliminates ROI on a large-scale software projects. Now, there'll be innovation in the CyberSec ecosystem that can help address that. Probably see a lot of evolution there, but certainly it's becoming a very material cost and not an afterthought anymore. No longer the guys in the basement. Those guys are front and center and often included in strategic thinking about technology projects and capital expenditure.
You were a White House advisor, and I know it was back, I think, was it 2017, 18, around that time?
16 and 17. Yeah, 2016, 17. 2017.
Okay. Are you still involved in it at all, or was it just those 2 years?
No, it was those 2 years. So I advised the White House Rural Council under the Obama administration in 2016 on technology workforce development and educating the educational business ecosystem in rural America. And that was my specialty area. And where I really advised them was, how do you create those routes to partnership in the Appalachian region? And we worked with a program called Tech Hire. So Tech Hire was really about, how do you invest in education to help give opportunity through technology to people who otherwise may not have considered technology as a viable option for them. We had a tremendous amount of success and really started to influence some policy. And then what we found, and a learning experience for me, was when there's an administrative change, there's a different way of doing things, and that plug can be pulled. So it doesn't matter if you spent 11 months or 13 months doing some of the most awesome work that you've ever done in your life, that can get pulled instantaneously. So not involved with that, but definitely have maintained my presence in rural economic developments. And frequently I'm engaging with members of that industry, with politicians about technology-based economic development. It's what I studied at Carolina. It's what I worked on at the White House, and it's been a passion of mine for well over a decade.
Awesome, man. You mentioned the Obama administration, and I always think about this movie that was on Netflix. It's called Leave the World Behind. And strangely enough, like, it's about how America gets taken down through a cyber attack and the communication power grid goes down or whatever. Have you seen the movie?
No, but take that as the second thing I have to follow up on with you.
Okay.
That's grid modernization and resiliency in a disaster. That's, we're working on a lot of that stuff. So this sounds right up my alley, just like you mentioned.
Yeah, I won't give any of the movie away then. But it was one of the only movies that the Obamas have funded and partially produced or advised on or something like that. So some of the things that happen in the movie, you're just like, man, are they trying to tell us something here? Like, what's going on? I did some doomsday prepping after watching that movie. It like scared me. So you got to watch it, man.
Yeah. Well, something like that, though, you don't realize how feeble our grid is, our electric grid, our telecommunications grid. Where I live in New Hill, North Carolina, we're about 40 minutes from Moore County, North Carolina. And last year, someone took a rifle and shot a substation. Moore County had to close schools, hospitals, and critical facilities for 4 days because some call them jackass or whatever went out there with a rifle. We live in a feeble grid that's based on 19th century and 20th century concepts and needs to be modernized rapidly. Hopefully the American Infrastructure Act accelerates a lot of that. We're seeing some signs, but for sure, that's not too far-fetched of a reality, Blake.
Yeah, and I followed that situation. It's funny you bring that up, and I didn't know. I need to look on a map, see where New Hill is, because I went to elementary school, middle school, high school in Pinecrest, and I definitely know a ton of people in Moore County, and I followed that situation. There's a lot of theories about what was going on there, because I mean, these had to be like carefully placed shots that can take out the whole grid. Not everybody just knows what to shoot at here, but it was very precisely done. And who knows, maybe it could have been just some rednecks from Robbins or something like that, but you know, who knows, man.
Absolutely. But point being, disaster recovery, resiliency, microgrid architecture, distributed energy management, those are all really vital importance to insulate against an attack like that, which might be become more likely in the future. Who knows? Or against a climate-related issue, storm. We need to be much more resilient than we are now.
For sure.
I recently read a book by Richard Cox called House of the Rising Sun. And it's the same sort of thing. So a celestial event causes an outage of our nation's electric infrastructure, and all sorts of calamity ensues, and all sorts of disaster ensues. And similar concepts there. And the point I take away is we do live. I see this, my professional existence, my consulting, what I've done over the course of the past, you know, arguably 9-10 years, I've been exposed to how feeble our infrastructure is in telecommunications and electric utility. And so being prepared is very important. And I think that that's really a driver of opportunity for all those tech workers who feel like the sun's setting and we're in the late stages of the industry and the job outlook's bad. It's problems like this. How do we make a 19th, 20th century legacy grid responsive to the types of challenges we're more likely to see over the course of the next 10 to 20 years? And how do you plan for scenarios like this, which might have been edge case scenarios, but as we saw in Moore County, are pretty real? There's opportunity in solving those problems. There's money to be made in solving those problems, and there's support globally and internally within the U.S. for being able to solve that through the private sector, through the public sector. So collaboration is going to be important in solving those problems, but that's where the money's going to be made, in my opinion, over the course of the next 5 to 10 years, and certainly next 20.
Yeah. So listen up, folks. How are you going to get involved? How are you going to set yourself up to sustain yourself and profit from this movement, right? Are you going to align yourself with some AI safe job, right? Robotics repair, some type of manual labor, or something to support a data center or the energy grid? Are there any startup ideas, right? So be thinking about that. And then I got a book for you, Tom. It's actually a story based in North Carolina. The writer is William Fortune, and the book is called 1 Second After. It was written in 2009. It's about what if an EMP blast goes off, and it's the whole story of how this family survived. And it's in a small American town, Black Mountain, North Carolina. So kind of in the mountains outside of Asheville.
My good friend, Glenn Hollingsworth at FM Systems, recommended that book. He just read it and we compared notes because we were reading similar material. Yeah, definitely. That's my next on the reading list. That's the second time I've heard.
Yeah, now you have to, man. The synchronicity of the universe is trying to tell you, you know, trying to tell you something here. Are you a everything happens for a reason kind of guy, or it's all random and you create your own path?
I certainly believe in divine signs. I've seen coincidences that are too strange to explain through randomness. And I certainly believe there are certain signals in the universe, certain times and place where people are put together in a situation to have a greater benefit in the future.
For sure. 100%. But man, it's been fun. And you know, I hope to have you back again, maybe when I don't have, you know, just like 250 followers on YouTube, maybe when I've got like 1,000, we'll do it again. And it'd be like phase two. But man, it's been fun. You've been great. A lot of information, awesome perspective. And yeah, it's been fun, man. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, for sure. And like, yeah, we definitely got to get together soon and also talk about, you know, hyperdrive and all that. Yeah. Let's do it again soon.
Yeah. Yeah. For those who don't know, after I got laid off from Jobot, just toying with the idea of going out on my own, starting a little solo shop, already got the website and the LLC, Hyperdrive Recruiting. One day it might show up on the internet. We'll see. I just need to get the courage. I'm getting a lot of encouragement from people. And then, you know, if I run into a situation that maybe above my head a little bit, I got you, Tom. I'm going to bring you in, man.
Definitely a strong supporter of the small business community. That's for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll talk more about that, man. But hey, thank you for coming on.
Thanks again, Blake. We'll talk soon.
All right, brother. Take care. Right. Bye.